The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to From the Median, a daily report from the front line of the pro-life movement, discussing two worldviews that are driving our culture in opposite directions. From the Median asks, which side of the road are you on? What direction do you want our culture to go? Tune in as we plan the route that takes us back to the culture of life. And now your host, Molly Smith.
Good evening and welcome to From the Median, where we are concerned with the middle ground, not just to understand both sides of an argument, but also to awaken the consciences of those who are neutral or indifferent to this, the greatest civil rights movement of our times, the pro-life movement. This evening, we continue our Bringing America Back to Life series. Tonight, we will feature a presentation from our 2018 convention. We know that you will be inspired by the ideas, the principles, the experience, and the wisdom of our speakers as they join us to pave the way back to life through prayer, action, voting, and education. It is my pleasure to introduce to you Walt Heyer, a former transgender with a passion to help others who regret gender change. An accomplished speaker, Walt travels extensively to share his story of redemption. His topic, Rethinking Transgenderism.
Thank you, Molly. Thank you very much for inviting me to come and speak. And before I say anything, though, I want to introduce my wife, Casey. You know, my testimony tonight, there she is. My testimony is really about the power and grace of Jesus Christ to redeem a very broken life. And we've been married now 20 years. And those are just some of the blessings that you get from entertaining and embracing and admitting you're wrong and getting down on your knees and saying you need the redemptive power of Jesus Christ, and he's entered my life. And that's what we're going to talk about tonight. And, you know, I was speaking in Hong Kong and actually at a Catholic gathering, and the room was full like this, and everybody in there spoke English except for one lady who was sitting real close, and she kept staring at me, and it was kind of uncomfortable, but she was just kind of looking at me, and I didn't know that she didn't speak English, so she couldn't understand one word I said, and it was probably the greatest talk. It was much better then than I'll give you tonight, probably. It was one of my best, and so I spoke and went... Oh, is this it? And so when I was done talking, and I was excited. I thought, wow, this is, man, I nailed it. And so she got up, and I thought, she's going to say something really sweet about what I said. And she asked the lady to translate what she had to say. And so they talked for a minute. And the translator looked at me with a smile, and she said... The lady doesn't speak English, but she wanted to tell you that you had beautiful hair. So I was very impressive. My wife, she likes my hair too. When we were first courting, she kept talking about my hair. And incidentally, it's the only thing on me that hasn't had work. But she kept talking about how beautiful my hair was. And I said, well, what do you think I'd look like if I was bald? And she said, single. So tonight we're going to talk about the whole difficult, weary story about transgenders and what happens to them. And this story that I give you tonight about my testimony, believe it or not, is 73 years in the making. I'm 77 years old. And I started this journey at the age of 4. So I come not only from having been redeemed and restored for over 25 years, I come with a lot of personal experience that I'll share with you that's pretty difficult. It's really difficult to get up in front of a large group of people and tell them about the biggest mistake that you ever made in your life. But it's important, isn't it, to be able to do that and do it every place that you possibly can to try to prevent someone else from making the biggest mistake they ever made in their life. So tonight what I want to do is I'm going to start a little video. It's about 14 minutes. But what it has in it, and I want to cue this up in advance, is I want you to look and listen, like you were saying, listen with your heart. In there are some people who are transgender people who've been redeemed like I have. And it's just a short clip. But I want you to listen for the brokenness. That's what's essential. We're broken. And each one of them has a story in this little clip. I'm going to run it now, and then I'll come back up, and we'll carry on.
I woke up from the operation, and I got these big boobs and the vagina and the whole thing, tubes hanging out here and there, and it's like, wow, what have I done?
In the beginning, God made human beings in His image, male and female, He created them. He commanded them to multiply through sexual union in a lifelong covenantal relationship with a member of the opposite sex. When they sinned, however, the entire creation fell, all of it, both man and nature. Man's heart was darkened, and he began to worship the creature rather than the creator. Today, we define intersex persons as those whose sex characteristics, including chromosomes, gonads, sex hormones, or genitals, are abnormal.
The intersex is a different category. It's a very, very small population, less than 1%. And these are individuals who are born with a mixture of Y, X and Y chromosomes, and sometimes the genitalia is not clearly male or female. This is a different medical problem altogether. This is not a psychological problem.
Now, the important thing to recognize about intersex individuals is that they are a different category than what we would call transgender individuals. Transgender individuals are those who have a normal male or female body. Biologically speaking, they have a normal male or female body, but they are experiencing a psychological incongruity between the way they feel and their actual body. That is very different than an intersex person who actually has a biological ambiguity in their body.
Intersex is a condition altogether different from being transgendered. What separates them is biology. Let's turn our attention to those who can truly be defined as transgendered. Technically, transgender is a non-medical umbrella term describing individuals whose gender identity or expression is at odds with the genetic sex with which they were born. This is now referred to as gender dysphoria. In modern parlance, however, transgendered individuals include transsexuals, transvestites, drag queens, and, incorrectly, intersex individuals. The term is independent of sexual orientation. Transsexual is a medical term that refers to individuals who have undergone some form of medical or surgical treatment for sex reassignment. But in modern use, the term also includes those who want treatment but are unable to get it for one reason or another. Transvestism, or cross-dressing, is a term that defines people who derive erotic pleasure from dressing as the opposite sex. But in modern parlance, it includes those who do so whether it causes erotic pleasure or not.
So when you study this population, you see that these are people with very fragile identity, very fragile, again, ego. We use the word ego, the sense of me.
The term gender identity refers to a person's experience or expression of their maleness or femaleness. To put it in very simple terms, how do they feel? Do they experience themselves? Do they perceive themselves as male or female? That term has been introduced because of the phenomenon of people finding that there's an incongruity between their inner experience of being male or female and their outward biology, their biological sex.
So far, they have not found like a biological or a genetic foundation or any prenatal factors that determine this kind of condition.
The technical term for it is gender dysphoria. It's recognized by people really on all sides of the debate over transgenderism. Where the differences lie is in understanding what would cause that kind of condition and also how it should be treated, and indeed if it should be treated. But usually for those who recognize that this does cause distress for the person involved, there's a question of, well, how is this distress to be resolved?
When it all started for me, I was about 4 years old. And my grandmother was, for whatever reason, enjoyed cross-dressing me. And by the time I was five, she had made me a purple chiffon full-length dress. And she just would get excited about me being a little girl. She liked me better as a little girl. She really reinforced that female appearance of mine. And I became so accustomed to cross-dressing and being appreciated and fawned over because she kept telling me how good I looked. I never got that when I was a boy from her. It was only when I was a girl.
I viewed my dad, you know, he emotionally was abusive to my mom as well as verbally. I watched my mom crumble underneath that. My little mind came to the conclusions that women are hated, women are vulnerable, and women are weak. And that's why he was picking on my mom, basically. And then when I watched my mom respond out of these things, I saw that she, you know, she was weak because she didn't know how to stand up for herself. She didn't know how to draw those boundaries because she was afraid of him. She acted like she was hated. And so when I looked at all of that, I'm like, okay, so I'm like my mom, and my dad's this way, and my mom's that way, and I don't want to be hated. You know, I don't want to be weak. I don't want to be vulnerable. So what else do I have but to become a man?
My father wasn't present because he was a very violent man. He was very abusive to my mother, and so she decided to leave him. And my mother battles with major depression, and so she fought very hard to stay present to my brother and I. And she was the one who sort of introduced my brother and I to my father, and we really saw my father primarily through my mother's eyes and through the eyes of my grandmother. And they didn't really like him because he was so abusive and so diabolical, in the sense that he didn't own his responsibility as my father. He didn't own that he was supposed to help me in my development as a young man. And so that was an emotional injury to me like you wouldn't believe.
My father owned his own business, so I really never had that close fellowship with my dad. He was just always busy, so I really never had that one-on-one intimate relationship between a father and a son. And my mom worked all the time as well, but she was more there for us.
I don't have any memories of being happy being a girl. It's just I always knew I was in the wrong body, that I was a little boy trapped in a girl's body. And it wasn't a passing phase. I think my parents thought I was just a tomboy and I would grow out of it like a lot of little girls do. But for me, it was an obsession. I just knew I was not complete unless I had male genitalia. And so when I was 9 years old, I heard about these things called sex change operations that we call sex reassignment surgery now. And I thought, that's the answer to my dilemma. So I decided as soon as I'm old enough and I have enough money, I'm going to change my name to David, get a sex change, and live happily ever after.
In 1965, psychologist John Money persuaded Johns Hopkins Hospital to begin performing sex reassignment surgeries. But after a 1979 study found that those who had had such surgeries were not more adjusted to society than their peers, the psychiatrist in chief at Hopkins Hospital, Dr. Paul McHugh, shut the program down. Head researcher John Meyer declared, "Surgery is not proper treatment for a psychiatric disorder. These patients have severe psychological problems that don't go away following surgery," a finding reinforced in a major 2011 study out of Sweden. According to Dr. McHugh, sex change is biologically impossible. Transgenderism is a mental disorder that merits treatment. People who undergo sex reassignment surgery do not change from men to women or vice versa. Rather, they become feminized men or masculinized women. Transgender feelings do not correspond with physical reality in a way similar to an anorexic who looks in the mirror and thinks that they are overweight. 70 to 80% of children who express transgender feelings will, over time, spontaneously lose those feelings. People who promote sexual reassignment surgery are collaborating with and promoting a mental disorder. Dr. McHugh also admonished those he called misguided doctors who administer puberty-delaying hormones to very young children, even though the drugs stunt the children's growth and risk causing sterility. Such actions, says McHugh, come close to child abuse.
I remember going to church as I was seeking the Lord and really wanting answers. And I remember walking in and listening to the message, and there wasn't really anything too profound about the message until they invited people to come up to receive prayer. Now, I didn't really think that I needed to surrender my life to the Lord or that I needed to repent. Of course I did, because I wasn't saved. So I went up and I received prayer and they prayed for me. And I remember this man praying for me, and he came up to me and he said, "The Lord loves you. He loves you and he cares for you. You are his son." And he just kept saying it over and over and over. And I just broke down in tears. I just broke down and I thought, wow, the Father loves me. He loves me. And he plunged into the depths of darkness to snatch me out like a brand plucked from the fire. This is what he was doing for me. And I experienced his love in such a profound way. I sensed the Holy Spirit so strongly, as though the Lord was standing right in front of me. And it was as though he had entered me. And it was a wind that I was experiencing. It wasn't just a feeling. It was, I had been resuscitated and brought back to life.
People who suffer from gender dysphoria, and it is a real condition, and we have to recognize that people really do suffer from this experience of this incongruity between the way that they feel about gender and their actual biological sex. People who are in that condition will say, well, why did God make me this way? Or if this is wrong, then how is God going to address this? How can it be fixed? What hope do I have in this world? And we need to recognize several things. We need to recognize first that we are all broken individuals at some level. We all experience brokenness at multiple levels, and that will include the sexual level as well. And that brokenness is not part of the original creation order. It's a consequence of the fall. It's a consequence of human sin. And so it's not accurate to say, well, God made me this way, therefore it needs to be affirmed, or therefore it's right for me to live this out in practice. We need to recognize that we are a combination of what is good, what God originally created, but also what has become corrupted by sin. But there is hope, and that hope for the transgender person is the same as it is for any other human being. That hope is that sin and its consequences have been decisively overcome by Jesus Christ. We may not experience the fullness of that salvation in this life. We continue to live as broken people, and there can be a measure of healing, there can be a measure of resolution, there can be a measure of comfort in this life, and many, many people can testify to that. Whatever form of sexual brokenness they have suffered from in the past, there can be a measure of healing. They have experienced the power of Christ in this life. But our hope does not lie in being fixed in this life. None of us will be perfectly mended from sin and its consequences in this life. And so we look ultimately to the future, to the restoration of all things, to the resurrection of the body, to our glorification as creatures, fallen creatures, who are restored in the image of God, specifically in the image of Christ, by our union with Him through faith.
Everyone has at least one major cross in this fallen world. Whether it be the child born without limbs, the one who develops intense homosexual desires, or the person who struggles with gender dysphoria. But the answer is the same. Say with the psalmist, "I lift up my eyes to the hills. Where does my help come from? My help comes from the Lord, the maker of heaven and earth. He will watch over your coming and going, both now and forevermore."
Thank you. Brokenness comes, you saw, in so many different ways. And when we're here talking about abortion and the way they kill babies before they're born unnecessarily, and then we see today young people, 3, 4, 5 years old, they're injecting them with hormone blockers. They're convincing them that they're the wrong gender. They're administering these blockers. They're doing surgeries, changing their genders at an earlier and earlier age. That's an abortion of another kind, isn't it? And we should be standing in front of the doctor's offices with a legion of people to protest these totally unnecessary sexual change procedures, because there isn't one person, not one doctor today, that can prove medically that a transgender even exists. It was invented by primarily three men. I've got two books in the back that talk about the story of how it came about. Alfred Kinsey, many of you know who he is. Harry Benjamin is the guy who coined the term transgender, transsexual. And the guy they talked about, John Money. John Money did research work at Johns Hopkins, and his research work that he did on this was all fake. He lied. And he was eventually proven to be wrong after his first two the first two people he worked on were the Raymer twins. And one of them had a botched surgery from Canada on a circumcision. So when he went to Hopkins, John Money said, "Well, we can just change this boy to a girl." And We know that just through nurturing him and through life, because we started it so early, he'll become a girl and adapt well. And so I won't go into the detail about what a depraved individual John Money was, but all three, Kinsey, Benjamin, and Money, were all pedophile activists. That's the origin of how it started. And they've convinced people that this is a necessary surgery. And there's absolutely no proof. And yet, political leaders are buying into it. So I'm here to set the record straight. And we need to listen and understand that when you have a population of people who are identifying as transgender and going through the physical changes of hormone treatment and surgical treatments, ladies and gentlemen, the people who identify as transgender before and after the change attempt suicide at a rate above 40%. How many medical procedures do you know that people advocate you should get done where the people who have the surgery attempt suicide at a rate above 40%? They would end it. Any other institution would end that surgical procedure because it's foolish. It doesn't work. In my own life, what happened was, and what we hear a lot about, was my grandmother affirmed me as a little four-year-old boy, affirmed me as a girl. And there isn't anybody in this room tonight that doesn't like to be affirmed. I mean, it's powerful. And I longed for that affirmation. But the only way I could get the affirmation was wearing the purple chiffon dress that she had made. And when I took that and internalized it, I realized that if I was going to be affirmed, I had to be a girl. She wanted me to keep that a secret from my mom and dad, because she only did this when I was babysitting, when she was babysitting me and I was at her house. So for about 2.5 years, this was a secret. But I got so into dressing and being affirmed, I realized when I got home, the purple dress was at Grandma's, and I didn't have that same affirmation as little Walt in the cowboy outfit. So I brought the purple dress home in a bag, didn't tell my grandma, and put it in my bottom dresser drawer. My mother found the dress with Dad sitting at the table and her sitting at the table. She confronted me about it. I broke down and cried and realized that I was about to divulge the secret. So I said, well, Grandma made it. Well, you could have set off a bomb. My dad was a part-time police officer, a judo expert, and an industrial goods salesman. He was not happy. And so it started this conflict between mom and dad. So I had started something by telling the secret about the purple dress. This started a conflict in the house that I felt deeply responsible for. So that added a burden to me, that why couldn't I keep the secret? Why did I have to bring the dress home and start this conflict? Now I couldn't go to Grandma's anymore, which was probably okay. At least I wasn't able to go unless my mom and dad were with me. My dad, bless his heart, this was in the mid-1940s. There were no internet, no cell phones. You couldn't look something up and find out about what it was. We didn't even know the term transgender. He didn't know what to do. So here I was, just a little bitty wad. I'm still a little bitty wad, come to think of it. Actually, if you could change who you're going to be, I'd be 6'3 and about 240. That didn't work either. So bless his heart, you know, he wanted me to be the man that he expected me to be. And his way of doing that was a hardwood floor plank as a discipline tool when I did something wrong. And believe me, I did a lot of things wrong. And I could tell his frustration from not knowing what to do. I mean, I felt bad for him. I didn't know what to do. He didn't know what to do, except to take that hardwood floor plank about this long. He'd drop my drawers and whack me on the butt until I had welts. And I remember many times my knees would buckle, and he'd just pick me back up. And I had to get to the point where I didn't want him to continue doing it, and crying wasn't working, so I decided if I didn't cry, he would think I was tough. So no matter how hard he hit me, I decided that I wasn't going to cry. And it did help. He thought I was becoming stronger and more of a man. But he didn't realize there was a brokenness there. You see, what Grandma had done, just as they do with kids today, that affirmation about being a different gender does something else, because it says there's something wrong with who you are. Do you get that? That's a key. It isn't so much we're affirming them over here, it's that we're really saying there's something wrong with you here. And into the young mind, it's like, well, what was wrong with me that I couldn't get affirmed as the little cowboy I kind of liked being? But it wasn't happening. So the affirmation planted the seed of gender dysphoria. It's gender confusion. Dysphoria is the opposite of euphoria. It's just another word for gender depression. I don't feel good about who I am. So with that seed planted, Dad's hitting me with a hardwood floor plank. He had an adopted teenage brother who was a little crazy, drank too much. And when he found out that I had been wearing a purple chiffon dress, he thought that I was fair game to tease, taunt, bully, whatever word you want to use. And so on our little street in L.A., there was a lot of kids. And when I got in the street and kids were gathered around, Uncle Fred would come over and pull my pants down and make fun of me. And he took it a few more steps than that. And eventually, during some of his drinking bouts, he began to sexually molest me. So now by this time, I'm about 9 years old. So I started life off with a grandma who put me in a purple dress, a dad who was trying to man me up with a hardwood floor plank, and an uncle who was sexually molesting me, and I wasn't 10 years old. Well, this is not really the best way to start life. And I had no tools. I was not equipped to deal with it. But I did the best I could. So I kept everything a secret. That whole thing in my life, I couldn't tell anybody. So I just internalized all of it, held it inside as best I could. By the time I was 12 or 13, I was mowing yards, making money. I was busy. That was the way I tried to keep that purple dress out of my head. I was busy. I delivered newspapers at 5 in the morning in L.A. In an area, if you were there today and delivered newspapers, you'd be dead by 6. And so I delivered newspapers. I worked at a gas station part-time, and I cut grass. That was staying busy. But I took on, internalized a name, Crystal West, as a female name, but I didn't tell anybody. I kept it inside. And strangely, transgenders typically are not homosexual. And I was not homosexual. Transgenders suffer from an identity issue, not from a sexuality issue. Most people, I've had many people call up and say, we're having a conference on homosexuality. Would you like to come and speak? I said, well, you need to get somebody who is a homosexual, because I wasn't. And I would say that the people I work with, 95% of them never had a homosexual experience or homosexual desire, and they're all transgenders. So that's just something people don't quite understand. If we understand its brokenness about their identity, their sexuality maybe was not broken in many cases. That doesn't mean there aren't some transgender people who aren't homosexual. It's just the vast majority of the ones are not. So as life went on, and I had a girlfriend in school, Lola Joy Phipps. Is that a great name? Wow. And she was hot, you know? And I was cool. If you were with Lola, you were hot. And so we went together for a while, and I had a 1934 Ford with a Chevy engine in it, and it was lowered chop top, 35 coats of Mandarin red lacquer. I was cool, and I had Lola. But I also had a purple dress still going on up here in my head that I couldn't make go away. And I finally told Joy, I said, you know, I've had this problem. And she broke down and cried, and she said, you know, I don't understand it, but we can't continue to see each other. And I understood that. I kind of knew that was coming. But she didn't tell anybody, so my secret was safe. So I went on through school, and I ran track, and I was very good in track. I was busy, but I wasn't good at school. I had poor grades. But I went on afterward, and I began to study drafting after I graduated from school at Pasadena City College, and I got a job at Libroscope, which worked on the Polaris missile. And eventually, with my skills at drafting, I became an associate design engineer at North American Aviation, working on cryogenic connectors for NASA. So by this time, however, I was married to Sue. Lola Joy Phipps was gone. I married Sue. We had two children, lived in a suburb of LA, and I had a very successful career on the Apollo space missions. And I wanted more, but I was still struggling with this purple dress. And I went into the automobile industry, and I became one of the top automobile executives for American Motors, Nash Rambler. There was a car for you. Yeah. They're not around, and there's a good reason for it. So I left Nash and went to work for another really, really stellar company, Renault. You know, two losers in a row, you know. That was not good. The Le Car. It was the only company car I ever had. I wanted to park around the block so the neighbors didn't know I was driving it. So I finally went to work for American Honda Motor Company. where I ended up becoming the national operations manager for American Honda Motor Company. I was one of the top executives for the corporation, unlimited expense account, 3 parking places. I was living the life. I didn't have to pay for anything. I could put everything on my expense account. No questions asked. But I had a purple dress still stuck in my head. And by this time, I was trying to cope with my success and the issue of gender, and I started using alcohol. And I was using alcohol to excess. And I started using to cope with this gender confusion and not knowing what to do. By now, I'm about 38 years old, so it'd been going on for almost 35 years. I started using cocaine and alcohol. And I, at the time, I was still working for Honda, exec, big rising star. I was working on the Acura division. I was going to become the division vice president for Acura. I decided that I was going to go see a gender therapist to work on this issue so that my career could take off and I could rid myself of this. So I went to one of those guys that's an expert in gender issues, Dr. Paul Walker. In fact, this guy wrote the original International Standards of Care for Gender Dysphoria on the treatment and diagnosis of people who had gender issues. He was the world expert. I was affluent. I could go to the best. And so I went to him at his San Francisco office on Union Street and met with him, and he said, you've got gender dysphoria. And the way you treat that is with hormone therapy and gender reassignment surgery. And I thought, geez, that seems pretty radical, isn't there? No, there's nothing else. That just seemed, for a guy that's married, an executive, it didn't seem to fit, but I kept checking in with him and I kept studying it. There was nothing else out there, nothing that said any different than that. That was the answer. So I waited the two appropriate years and eventually divorced my wife and Walker wrote me a letter to have gender reassignment surgery, and I had my surgery in April of 1983. And I became Laura Jensen. And I told Honda about it, and they put everything that I had in a brown box about this big and marched me to the gate, and my career was over. That was the last significant employment job that I had, October 25th, 1983. Within a short space of time, I was homeless, living in a park in Long Beach, face down in my own vomit. Now, I kind of knew at that point that I'd made a big mistake. But I wanted to make the best of it. After all, I was brilliant. I was an executive. So I decided to go to AA, and I called somebody that I knew and said, do you know some way I could get to an AA meeting? And they said, yeah. So this friend of mine, Michael, I still know Michael. Michael and Ben, and they came and picked me up and took me to an AA meeting in Pacific Palisades, probably the wealthiest area in LA. And I walked into that meeting, and no one would get within 30 feet of me because I smelled and looked so bad. I was just a mess. But I started my journey to recovery then And eventually I started going to see Dr. Dennis Guernsey at Fuller Seminary and trying to find my way back, but I was Laura. I had worked at several different jobs, cleaning houses, washing dishes, menial tasks. And I decided to move in with a pastor in Pleasanton, California at the request of Dennis Guernsey. And I moved in with his family, the pastor and his wife, and they embraced me, and we sat up till 3 o'clock in the morning almost every night talking about what we're talking about tonight. How did you get here? Where's it going to go? And so eventually I decided that I was going to, as Laura, I was going to study how to help people who are struggling with this. So I went to UC Santa Cruz and started studying psychology. And I was reading through some books, and I realized that in the books it talked about transgender people having separation anxiety and these other kind of mental disorders. Well, I never heard that before. Dr. Walker didn't say anything. And as I began to study this, I realized that transgender people are broken and suffer from psychological, emotional, and sexual disorders that nobody ever treats them for. They just give them hormones and cut body parts off. That's the treatment. And I was one of those people. So now how was I going to crawl my way back? And as I began to go back and become more involved in my own treatment, I was going to see two therapists, and I was going every day, every single day for months to two different therapists. One time, I was even seeing three, trying to deal with the biggest mistake of my life and how was I going to crawl my way back to reality and be able to help other people. And finally, I was working my way through recovery from alcohol and drug addiction and working on my own life. And I realized that I needed a church. I started going to a church. Well, Dennis Guernsey said, I've got a friend of mine who's a pastor at a church, and you need to go to church. And I'm Laura. So he contacted the pastor and said, you need to go to this church. And I said, okay, it's close to my house, I'll go. I went on Sunday, and I went in as Laura, signed into the newcomer's book. The ladies surrounded me. They were real nice. I signed in. They all sat with me. One of them was the pastor's wife. And the sermon was great. I was done, went outside, had my donut and coffee, communed with everybody, got in my car, went home, and I thought, wow, okay. I'm starting to get this going again. I'm going to be okay. Later on that afternoon, I looked out my window of the little condo I was in, and the pastor was getting out of his car, walking to the front door. I thought, wow, he's going to welcome me because, you know, my Dennis Guernsey told him about me, and I was in church, and I was with his wife in church, and it was cool, right? Isn't this sounding good? He knocked on the door. I opened the door up. He took one step inside, and he goes, we don't want your kind in our church. I smiled. I looked at him and I said, okay, what kind do you want? I mean, we're all broken. He turned around and left. I went to another church, but I decided this time not to go to the Sunday service. I wanted to meet the pastor on Wednesday when he was in his office, and I sat across from him. And I said, Pastor Jeff, I'm Laura. Are you going to try to change me to Walt? Jeff is this big, huge football player from years back. And he leaned back in his big chair, twiddling his pencil. And he says, you know, Laura, he said, my job is to love you. It's God's job to change you. And don't be surprised if he doesn't. change you. That church allowed me to come in and be Laura, and I even gave the elders a talk, and they gave me a talk too, and they gave me a real talk, you know, and they were all nervous. I made, you know, transgenders in the church make people nervous. They're scary. They're complicated. Like me, some of them are nuts. Do I have a witness? Yes. And so they're troubled people. They're broken. But who in the church isn't broken? Who isn't broken? And if we don't allow them to come in the church, how are we going to redeem them through Jesus Christ? If we reject people because they're broken, then we better shut down every church in the country today. I was still recovering and going through all the stuff with my recovery, and I was seeing one of the PhD psychologists, Christian psychologists, and I decided to have him work through my fourth step with me, which was part of the process of writing down all the things that had happened, the purple dress, the hardwood floor plank, being sexually abused, and all the crazy things I did, admitting that I had made a huge mistake, the biggest mistake of my life, getting on my knees and saying, Lord, I was wrong. I don't blame grandma. I don't blame my dad. I don't blame my uncle. I am solely responsible for my life. Because if I sit around blaming everybody else and expecting them to change, nothing is going to change. I need to change me. I can't change everybody else. All these things are written down on this yellow lined piece of paper, and I'm sitting in his office in Pleasanton, California, and we spent time going over each item and kind of regurgitating it. And when we were done talking about each one of these things psychologically, emotionally, we went outside and we took the yellow lined paper, and David, the therapist, put a match to him and let him burn. The paper just burned, and it burned. It went up, and the wind just took it away. And it was like, that's cool. It's symbolic. This stuff doesn't really go away, but it did feel better. And then he said, you know, what we need to do now is go inside and pray. Well, I knew this guy, and he prayed a lot longer than I wanted to pray. I was kind of tired after all this. He was one of those guys that just prayed forever. I'm good in about 2 minutes, I'm done. I don't care how much you got going, 2 minutes long enough. Not David, 2 hours.
You have been listening to Walt Hyo, who is a former transgender with a passion to help others who regret gender change. This presentation is available to you on our YouTube channel at www.bringingamericabacktolife.org.
From the Median is listener-supported. Visit our website, fromthemedian.org, for further information or to make a donation to continue to make this radio program possible. Email us, radionews@fromthemedian.org, or call 440-668-4049. Through our fromthemedian.org website, you can download this or previous programs for your listening pleasure, or sign up to receive our weekly preview of upcoming guest interviews. Tune in every weeknight at the same time to listen to another great interview on From the Median as we plan the route that takes us back to the culture of life.
From the Median is brought to you by Cleveland Right to Life.
3-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.